You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 154, our 20th question and answer episode. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Pretty good. Busy as usual, but good.
Well, that's good. Mike, you got any trips coming up here anytime soon? Speaking of
I do. Or? Yeah. Indian Harbor Beach in Florida on May 20th. I got a note about that from the organizer this morning. And they have 90 people already signed up for that event. So the guy who's organizing it guessed that there were about 60% of those who were familiar with the content, and the rest he guessed probably were not. But if you are interested or in the area, you know, within a couple hours, I guess, of Indian Harbor Beach, Florida, please, you know, by all means, come over on the May 20th and introduce yourself, you know, when we get a chance to do that. But you can get all the information on my website, drmsh.com. Just go into the calendar, click on the event, and you'll see where you need to sign up and the logistics and whatnot.
Well, Mike, we're going to be taking a little break with this episode and the next episode from Ezekiel, and we probably should just go ahead and talk about, we got a special guest next week.
Yeah, we do. Next week, we're going to be interviewing David Limbaugh. Now, a lot of you already will know who David Limbaugh is, other than being Rush Limbaugh's brother. David is the author of a number of books in Christian circles. His previous one was The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament, Jesus on Trial. His next one is The True Jesus, Uncovering the Divinity of Christ in the Gospels. So what's special about this is David and I have been friends for, I don't know, a year, year and a half. He is a big user of Logos Bible software, so we've corresponded quite a bit about that. He's read The Unseen Realm and really likes that. So we've had a number of conversations, you know, theologically, and he asked me to read the draft of this book, his most recent one, and give it a blurb, and I did that. And so if you get the book or you go to Amazon and flip it over, you'll see my blurb at the top of his book. And I asked him, you know, when we were chatting about doing the blurb, I said, hey, you know, it'd be great if you came on the podcast. People could get to know you a little bit more, you know, not as a political commentator, but as somebody who's really interested in scripture, maybe get your testimony, that sort of thing. And he was real enthusiastic to come on the podcast. So we'll have him for the, as Larry King used to say, for the full hour next week. So it'll be fun. I'm sure it'll be a good interview.
Yeah, looking forward to it. All right, Mike, well, why don't we just get into our questions here? If you're ready,
yep.
I'm ready.
Sure.
All right. Well, our first question is from Molly. She's got a couple questions. But her first question is about Numbers 21, 4 through 9, and episode 103 of the Naked Bible Podcast about the bronze snake. And she wants to know if Dr. Heiser can please unpack this. It just seems bizarre that looking at a snake on a pole could cure a snake bite. I know the snake intertwined on the pole is a modern symbol of medicine. I know that Hezekiah had the bronze snake destroyed because the people were burning incense to it. But what is the meaning of this episode in Numbers?
Yeah, well, I thought we had actually done that in episode 103. So for those listening, I'd say go listen to episode 103. But to abbreviate it, the serpent and the serpent image, you know, the thing fashioned there didn't heal anybody. It was God who healed the people who looked at it. So God is healing the afflicted, whoever they were, when they looked at the serpent on the pole. In other words, when they showed faith, when they trusted in the thing God told Moses to make, and when they, in faith, did the thing God told them to do through Moses, God healed them. I think as far as the larger meaning, you know, back in the episode in 103, we talked about how things like this, you know, from a scholarly context, you know, again, looking at the wider ancient Near Eastern context, we talked about sympathetic magic. We talked about serpents being symbols of healing in the ancient Near East. And again, those things are what they are. If you're new to the podcast, sympathetic magic is the idea of you know, how people would fashion an object that corresponded to something they wanted, you know, the deity to do. Okay, that's sort of the classic example of this in the Bible is Genesis 31, the Jacob and Laban story, where Jacob lays out these different, you know, variegated rods, and then the cattle there, you know, have babies according to, again, what was laid out. Again, that is a classic example of sympathetic magic. But the issue with it is God told him to do that. So there you have in Genesis 31 an episode where God tells Jacob to do a certain thing to thwart, you know, Laban's attempts to cheat him. And Jacob obeys. Jacob believes that if he does this certain thing, not that the branches he lays out are going to do something, but that God will do something in response to his faith. And so this is how the Old Testament, again, incorporates these sorts of ideas. So back, you know, to the serpent issue, you know, it's really the same issue there. When you do something that God, you know, wants you to do, and the people, you know, Moses responds by making the object, the people respond by doing what God said needed to be done to be cured, then he cured them. The teaching point is that the God who harms is also the God who heals. In other words, there's no greater deity or power to appeal to. You know, God's giving you the instructions. God's the one who afflicted you. If you follow God's instructions, now God will heal you. So it's a pretty simple teaching point. Now, if there was any connection to Egypt in terms of what was fashioned, you know, what it looked like, and again, we aren't told, but again, just for the sake of the discussion, if there was any connection to Egypt back here, it would, again, because a lot of these people, the Israelites, you know, had been in Egypt, it would have reinforced the idea that the healing had a divine source and not an earthly one, because they would have been familiar with, you know, things like the uraeus, the cobra, and the way the Egyptians viewed these things. But there would have, you know, there would have been no ambiguity that, okay, we're healed not because of anything we could do to help ourselves. We're healed because of the power of God, and we're doing what God asked us to do. And the image, you know, the serpent on the pole, again, becomes sort of this, you know, mediating object, you know, something tangible that they can look at and respond to in obedience to get the result that God said, if you do this, I will heal you. And so they do. I don't think it's really much more complicated than that. In the episode in 103, we talked about how there's really nothing specific to connect the serpent here to Genesis 3. Again, that because people would have associated it with evil there. There's no hint of that in the passage. But it becomes a good type, you know, a type is a nonverbal prophecy, a precursor, something that prefigures something to come later. It becomes a really interesting type for Jesus, you know, lifted up on the cross, and that, of course, is how it's used in the New Testament. Again, responding in faith to the thing that God said, if you believe this, then you'll get XYZ result, you know, eternal life, forgiveness of sins in the case of the cross. So it becomes a real nice analogy, typological prefiguring of what happens at the cross.
All right, Molly, second question is, can you please discuss the arguments for putting the book of Daniel into early and into late?
Yeah, this is a long and convoluted subject. I'll just start off. Let's just talk about why the debate is even a debate. In other words, how it originated. I'm gonna actually use Stephen Miller's Daniel commentary. This is in the New American Commentary series, and this whole series is pretty conservative theologically. So it gives the early date, you know, a fair shake here, rather than just dismissing it. And in fact, you know, I think defends it reasonably. And for the sake of the discussion, the early date of Daniel is the one that would say that the book was written in the 6th century BC. That is during the Babylonian period, during the events which are actually described, the historical context that's actually described in the book of Daniel. The late date of Daniel is centuries later, the 2nd century BC. So, you know, roughly 400 years later. Now, you say, well, how did we even get to there being a debate? Well, Miller says this. He says, traditionally, it has been held that Daniel wrote the book substantially as it exists today, that the prophecy is historically reliable, and that its predictions are supernatural and accurate. Likely there was some modernization of the language as the work was copied throughout the centuries, but otherwise it originated with the prophet in the 6th century BC. In modern times, many scholars have maintained that the book in its present form was produced, and that's an important word, composed, produced, by an anonymous Jew during the 2nd century BC, writing under the pseudonym Daniel, and that it consists of non-historical accounts and pseudo-prophecies. The purpose of the work in this scenario was to encourage Jewish believers in their struggle against the tyrant Antiochus IV, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, who lived from 175 to 163 BC. In other words, during the Maccabean period in Jewish history between the Testaments. Now, this supposition, Miller continues, may be called the Maccabean thesis or hypothesis. According to this view, the book of Daniel would be the latest of the Old Testament scriptures. Often scholars who accept the Maccabean thesis identify the second century writer as a member of the religious sect known as the Hasidim. Now, one more section from Miller. For almost 1,800 years, the traditional view, that is the early view, went virtually unchallenged within both Judaism and Christianity. Porphyry, who basically can be dated to the 200s, let's just, the date that's given in Miller, you know, but again, it's debated, but 232 to 303 AD, again, somewhere in that range. I don't know how precise we can actually be, but Porphyry was an exception to this. Eisfeld, who's a German biblical scholar, explains, quote, "The Neoplatonist Porphyry in the 12th book of his polemical work entitled Against the Christians," unquote, indicated the 2nd century BC as the actual date of the book's composition and described the greater part of its prophecies as Vaticinia ex eventu, that is, it's Latin for prophecies or predictions made after the event. His polemic against the Christians has been lost. In other words, that's a document that we can't go read now. It has been lost, but its argument is preserved in Jerome's commentary on Daniel. Now, Jerome is the guy who created the Vulgate, translated the Bible into Latin. Porphyry reasoned from the a priori assumption that there could be no predictive element in prophecy. According to Jerome, Porphyry claims that the person who composed the book under the name of Daniel made it all up in order to revive the hopes of his countrymen, not that he was able to foreknow all of future history, but rather he records events that had already taken place. Again, that's the end of Miller's quote, and of course he quotes other people within that. Porphyry's view ultimately was condemned by the church. Nobody really bought it, but that view now has become kind of, you know, a focal point, at least a touch point for the late view of Daniel. Now, I should point out that there are evangelicals who take the late view of Daniel and don't talk about Daniel the way that Porphyry did. In other words, they don't dismiss the idea that, yeah, prophets really can foretell the future and that God instructs them to do so in a number of occasions. They view Daniel, though, as, again, having this after-the-fact idea, because it is a known genre in the Second Temple period. So there are a number of reasons why they would look at Daniel that way and not at another prophet and his predictions the same way. So it's not, we can't just call somebody who takes a late view of Daniel as a Porphyrian, if that's even a word. That would be an unfair criticism. It might apply, but it could be very unfair. So having said that, let's just summarize again some of the issues. I think this is really what the question was after. So a late date argument would be made as follows. It's not simply about rejecting the idea of predictive prophecy. Scholars who accept the idea that God can reveal the future to people, but who still take a late date view of Daniel would argue the point on the basis of the following ideas. Number one, much of Daniel 9 through 11 does, in fact, fit the Maccabean period, pretty closely, in fact. Only later material in Daniel, roughly from Daniel 11:36 onward, doesn't really jive well with historical events in the Maccabean period. Most late-date advocates would say Daniel made errors here, but evangelicals who take the late date would speculate that, well, after verse 36, we have some predictive prophecy going on. Most evangelicals who would take the late date of Daniel would be more generous than critics who'd say, well, Daniel just screwed it up after verse 36. Of course, if you take the early date, you're saying, well, Daniel predicted it all anyway, but that still doesn't answer, you know, the fact that after verse 36, we have historical problems. But if you take an early date, you'd say, well, when we hit verse 36, that's talking about events in the distant future. So late date evangelicals, many of them, I would say, to be fair, most of them, would say the same thing once you hit verse 36. So that was item number one. Item number two, you can argue the late date based on the fact that there are features of late Aramaic in the book of Daniel. Now, Aramaic's like any other language, like English. It goes through stages. Those stages are discernible. What an Aramaic writer would have done in the 6th century, you know, is going to differ from what he might do grammatically centuries later. And Daniel does have elements of late Aramaic in it. That's just a fact. It's just the way it is. Third, the presence of Persian and Greek words, which would both be later than the Babylonian period that the book itself describes, is an argument for a late date. In terms of Greek, I'm gonna bring in Gleason Archer here. I think Archer has a pretty good treatment of this issue, and he borrows a lot from an old scholar, Robert Dick Wilson, who was an old Princeton scholar, kind of a sort of a personal hero of mine very early in my education. But Archer says this: these three words in Daniel 3:5 that are Greek, they're Kitharis, Psalterion, and Symphonia. These are definitely Greek words. The last of these three does not occur in existing Greek literature until the time of Plato, which is 370 BC, at least in the sense of a musical instrument. From this, it has been argued that the word itself must be as late as the 4th century in Greek usage. But the fact is, you've got three Greek words here that on the surface shouldn't be there if the book was written in the 6th century BC, or at least that's the way the argument goes. Fourth item, Daniel in the Hebrew canon. Okay, the Hebrew canon has its own ordering of Old Testament books, and it's different than what you get in your English Bible. In the Hebrew canon, Daniel is not placed among the prophets. It's placed in the last section of the Hebrew Bible known as the Writings, and there's a lot of late material in the Writings. Five, the Jewish writer Ben Sira, who lived circa 180 BC, in his writings, the reference here is Sirach 40, chapters 44 through 50. He's listing significant Israelite or biblical characters in these chapters, and he fails to mention Daniel, although he does mention Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and collectively the 12 minor prophets. So some reason from that Ben Sira didn't know Daniel because Daniel didn't exist yet as a book. Sixth, scholars often fixate on the word Chaldean, which they say is late, and again, shouldn't be there if Daniel was written in the 6th century. And then lastly, the seventh sort of trajectory here is that Daniel is very obviously in the apocalyptic literature genre, which if you're just sort of counting genre noses, in other words, the number of ancient books that have apocalyptic features, and you say, what are apocalyptic features? You have angels coming and talking to people specifically about the future. You've got sort of cosmic imagery about heaven and hell in the future, you know, impending disaster, the ultimate afterlife, day of the Lord kind of stuff. But again, associated with angels specifically, and again, the way they come and dispense messages, those are sort of classic stock elements of apocalyptic literature. Think of the book of Revelation. Most of the content of Revelation is mediated through angels, okay? So that kind of literature, if you're just counting the number of books that would sort of have those features as opposed to the ones who don't, overwhelmingly, that kind of literature is dated from the 3rd century BC onward. So it would be late. So that's how you would argue a late date for the book of Daniel, regardless of the prophecy issue. Now, what about an early date? How would the early date argue its position and defend itself among, you know, against some of these other things? Well, here's how it would be done. Events in the book are set in the 6th century BC, and they're very consistent with known historical figures, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and also events, the exile of the Jews to Babylon. In fact, the book gives us a date, you know, that about the exile, and so that's when the book is set, and there's no reason to think that it shouldn't be, you know, situated in terms of its composition in that period. So you have that. Daniel 1:1 again gives you an exact date, so why not just accept that? Number three, Daniel also has features of early Aramaic. Yes, it does have features of late Aramaic, but it also has clear features of early Aramaic. Now, late daters would say, well, that's because the guy who was writing late wanted to give the book the feel of antiquity. So he's living after the fact, and he would just sort of throw in some of this late grammatical stuff to give the reader of the original language, again, this feel of antiquity for the book. And that's how they would counteract that. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of its Aramaic portions, you have features of both early and late Aramaic in there. Number four, they would say, well, in regard to Ben Sira's list, yeah, it's a long list. I mean, it spans five or six chapters, but it is still selective if you actually read it. In other words, Ben Sira doesn't mention everybody he could mention in terms of a noble biblical character in those chapters. So it's not a big deal that Daniel's not there. He just got skipped for whatever reason. Fifth, Daniel's placement in the canon, you know, in the late portion, in the portion of the writings and not the prophets, the early date would say, early daters would say, that's due to his primary role of a government administrator in Babylon and not as a classical prophet like the other guys. So they would say, look, the fact that it's placed in the writings just sort of situates it historically, because the other stuff in the writings, a lot of it, you know, can certainly has this sort of orientation, Babylonian, Persian Empire kind of stuff. If you're familiar with the writings, you know, maybe some of your favorite books, you know, are going to be in there, like Job, and you've always heard that Job is early. Well, that, you know, that's one of those things we could do an episode on that alone. But there's no guarantee that Job was early. Job has a lot of features of late Hebrew. Again, Hebrew's like Aramaic, like English. There's clear stages in the language. There's nothing that necessitates Job being an early book, even though everybody's always taught that. Well, there's no reference to the covenants or the law. Well, maybe they're just not part of the storyline. I mean, that's not a really good argument. Well, they're doing patriarchal stuff. Yeah, well, Job, again, is from the land of Uz, which isn't in Canaan. I mean, this is a Transjordanian situation. So why would we think that they're doing theocratic stuff associated with Moses and the temple? They don't live there. Again, there's no reason specifically that you have to take Job early. So if you look at the collection of the writings, the late stuff, you're going to say, well, this order doesn't make any sense. This other stuff isn't late. Well, again, it may be, but early daters would say, well, Daniel winds up there because of, you know, what the book describes, its setting and his role as an administrator in Babylon and not as a classical prophet in, you know, the promised land proper, like the other prophets were. So again, that's the counter argument. Number six, Herodotus. This is in regard to the term Chaldean. Herodotus, writing in 450 BC, uses Chaldean as a term. You say, well, that's still later than the 6th century. It is. But there are Assyrian records that go well before the Babylonian period that mention the Chaldu, okay, in cuneiform inscriptions. And the Chaldu were, again, prominent officials in the bureaucracy. So R.K. Harrison's Introduction to the Old Testament points that out. Robert Dick Wilson pointed it out in his work at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century. Again, the Chaldean argument really isn't that good of an argument for a late date, but you'll still see it. Seventh, what about those Greek words? Well, I'll reference you to Archer here again, a little paragraph. Archer writes, we now possess less than 1/10 of the significant Greek literature of the classical period, and so we lack sufficient data for timing the precise origin of any particular word or usage in the development of the Greek vocabulary. I think that's a fair point. It should carefully be observed that these three words, again, that are in Daniel, are names of musical instruments, and that such names have always circulated beyond national boundaries as the instruments themselves have become available to the foreign market. These three were undoubtedly of Greek origin and circulated with their Greek names in Near Eastern markets, just as foreign musical instruments and musical terms have made their way into our own language, like the Italian word piano and viola. That's the end of his quote. Now, what Archer's saying here is, look, since these objects, these Greek terms are all about objects, musical instruments, just because they don't occur in literature doesn't mean that someone in the ancient Near East had never encountered one of these instruments or the persons or, you know, person or persons who played them, who would have told them what the thing was called. So in the course of just cultural interaction, maybe through trade or shipping or, you know, who knows how people would have carried these things, you know, from Greece into the ancient Near East, and people in the ancient Near East would have, you know, encountered them in return and, you know, have heard them played and said, "Hey, what is that thing you're playing over there?" And then they would have heard the term. And the term could have wound up in foreign discourse, just like piano and viola do in English. They could have wound up in foreign discourse without ever actually being described in literature. Again, that to me, that's a fair point. You could see how that could happen with objects of this nature. Lastly, what about apocalyptic, the genre issue? Well, this is one I think that the late daters really sort of overhype. And I'm not going to say it's not important. It is important, and there is an obvious mass of apocalyptic material that's late. That's all true. They're not making that up. But apocalypticism begins in Mesopotamian literature. And the best source of this, and it's dense reading, and it's really, really hard to find, okay? It took me years to find this book. And that is by Helge, H-E-L-G-E, Kvanvig, K-V-A-N-V-I-G. The book is called The Roots of Apocalyptic, subtitle, The Mesopotamian Background of the Enoch Figure and of the Son of Man. Now, we all know from the content of this podcast that Second Temple Jewish material has deep Mesopotamian roots. And so the point here is that apocalypticism has deep Mesopotamian roots. This is not a 3rd century BC invention. Now, if Daniel is living in Mesopotamia, Babylon, the chances are reasonable that he could have encountered apocalyptic literature, apocalyptic stuff, okay, or that what he is writing about the future, again, would have had some of these stock elements in it, just literarily. This is how you would write this kind of literature. And so Daniel is literate. He's well trained. We know this from the book of Daniel. He's trained in all, you know, the skills and the sciences and the knowledge of, you know, his captors. So if he's used to having a certain set of ideas conveyed with certain literary conventions, if that's what he's been educated in, it's not unreasonable to expect that his own material would have followed course, would have followed the mold, because that happens everywhere in the Bible. People write things using the literary conventions of how things are written. Because if you don't follow them, you look like a hack. You look like you don't know what you're doing. You don't look like a professional writer, is the point. So the apocalyptic argument is, I mean, it's legit, but it's not as powerful as you think. I mean, there is reason for debate here, but it's not a completely one-sided debate, is my point. So there you go. That's how the early view and the late view would be defended. And I'll wrap up just by saying this. Another quote here from, I don't know if I can even pronounce this guy's name correctly. His first name is in bad need of a vowel here. You know, let me buy a vowel. It's Zdravko. Zdravko Stefanovic. Okay, I don't know if I'm really messing that name up or not, but he wrote the volume in the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament supplemental series called The Aramaic of Daniel in the Light of Old Aramaic. What he does is he studies old Aramaic inscriptions, and he compares the grammar and syntax to what you find in Daniel. So he's starting out with certifiably old material, old imperial Aramaic, that sort of stuff that you would expect in the 5th century BC. And then he compares it to Daniel. Here's what he writes in his conclusion. Quote, "The contextual discussion of the literary and grammatical features of old Aramaic texts when brought into contact with Daniel's Aramaic yields the following results. Number one, the often assumed uniformity of Old Aramaic cannot be maintained any longer, since a study of the grammar of Old Aramaic inscriptions gives a different picture of this aspect of Old Aramaic texts. The Tel Fakhria inscription, with its sizable number of unexpected phenomena, points strongly to this. Okay, number two, this study contributes to the present discussions of Daniel's Aramaic in that it presents answers to certain objections raised regarding the traditional dating of Daniel's Aramaic. Three factors must be accounted for in any conclusion on Daniel's Aramaic. They are geography, chronology, and the literary character of the text. Third, the text of Daniel in Aramaic, in its present form, including chapter 7, contains, and here's the payoff, a significant amount of material similar to old Aramaic texts. The key desideratum coming out of this study is that the search for features of Daniel's Aramaic of an early date should be pursued more intensely in the future, unquote. So this is the most recent study, it's 1992, most recent, you know, book-length study on the Aramaic of Daniel. And basically he says, you can't date the book by the Aramaic. You just can't do that. It's got as many features of old as it does late. So that ain't working. It's not an argument that really, you know, can be used as positive proof for a late view. So that's what I would say in response to the question. I know that was long, but that gives you a rundown on how each side is argued. And again, I understand why people care about it. Even if you take the late view, when you hit verse 36, though, unless you want to just say, well, Daniel's a screw up and this thing's full of errors now. If you don't want to say that, you still have to say he's predicting the future. So in one sense, it is about a theological commitment, even for late daters. And so I would stress, look, if you run into somebody who takes a late view of Daniel, you got to probe that a little bit with questions. Well, you know, what do you mean? You know, do you rule out predicted prophecy totally for any portion of the book? And do you rule out predicted prophecy totally for the whole Old Testament or the whole Bible? I mean, if the answer is yes there, then you've got someone with a theological bias. But the answer might be no. Okay, and so then, you know, you have a different discussion on your hands. So we'll just leave it there.
All right, Colin wants to know what Zechariah 5 is about. Female angels, women with wings of a stork? What?
Yeah, I would say the first piece of advice here is don't overly literalize the text. I mean, this is a vision. Visions characteristically have symbols. This is no exception. So the women in the vision are never called angels. That's the first thing. They're called women. In fact, verse 10 distinguishes the angel that is in the scene to begin with, distinguishes that angel from the women. So you have two features of the text that divorce the women from the angel category. Now, I'll grant this is a question because of the repeated ubiquitous imagery in our own day of angels having wings, something that isn't a biblical idea. It's medieval. Okay. Or, you know, I'll be more generous. It might be the result of a conflation of seraphim and cherubim with angels. In other words, assuming that seraphim and cherubim are angels, even though neither of those terms, seraphim, cherubim, are ever actually called angel, malach in Hebrew. They're never called that. But again, in our tradition, we conflate all of these things. We mash them all together. So again, I think really this is a result of early Christian medieval conflation of all heavenly beings into either good guys, those are angels, or bad guys, those are demons. And it's a simplistic angelology and demonology that we've talked about on this show and in my books a number of times. Now, having said that, though, even good commentators will somehow assume, some of them, that cherubim are like humanoid in appearance, and then they'll extrapolate that to this whole angel question. Again, even though they're never called angels. If you look at the Exodus references to the cherubim on the ark, okay, it never says that they're humanoid in form. Again, that's the movies or some artistic representation. The ones in Ezekiel have a human face, but they've got four faces. So there aren't really many people that have four faces. One of the faces is human in appearance, and they have hands, but the rest of it is creaturely. And again, if you go back and look at Babylonian art, you're going to find these features. And they're clearly not humans and not angels the way angels are actually described in the text. The way that angels are actually described is human-looking. They look like men. They look like people. And they're never said to have wings. But again, these things get confused. Now, if you have Bible software, I would invite you. Do a lemma search for all of the places with Karuv and Malach, you know, cherub, angel. You're going to come up with zero hits. Okay, they don't occur in the same passage, right? They're just not there. Malach and Kanaf, the word for wing, you're going to get zero hits. Okay, these terms are not used to describe the other. Now, as far as what you know might be the meaning here, I think Klein has a nice summary. Again, this is the New American Commentary. This is the most succinct summary I could find for this. Klein says, the woman in the basket appeared suddenly. And this is the vision of the woman in the basket. Okay, we got that. Likewise, in the same scene, the two winged women appeared before the prophet. The angel, who's with the prophet, gives no indication of the identity of these two women who now appear in the vision, only offering a few cursory remarks. Curiously, the text describes the women as having the wings of a stork. Although the stork is an unclean animal, Leviticus 11:19, the comparison between the women's wings and those of the stork seems to focus on the size and strength of their wings, not on any notion of uncleanness. Consequently, the winged women flew with strength and grace, as did their animal counterparts. In the vision, the two women carried the basket with the woman inside from Jerusalem back to Babylon. Now, the question, I'll just stop here. The question to ask is, what about the woman in the basket? Well, if you read Zechariah 5, she is a symbol of evil, of wickedness. They're taking the wickedness back to Babylon, where it belongs. Continuing with Klein, the angel may also intend an additional meaning for stork. In other words, when the angel describes these women as having the wings of the stork, there might be something else going on. Even though the stork ranks among the unclean animals, it also had the reputation for caring tenderly for its own young. This observation lies behind the pun in the Old Testament between the Hebrew word for stork, which is kasidah, and the word rendered loyal or faithful, kasid. This same tender care for the helpless young marks the Lord's treatment of his young, the Israelites. That's why he's getting rid of the wickedness and sending it back to Babylon. So there might be some wordplay going on here. I think the chances are good that that's the case, because this is Zechariah. This is post-exilic. This is after the exile. Coming back to the land, we take the wickedness back to Babylon where it belongs. And this is an act of the grace of God. Again, not counting their sins against them and bringing them along. No, you leave them back there, and then you come home. So I think that's the point of the passage.
All right, our next question comes from two of our listeners tracking on the same idea. They're from Tammy and Nathan, so I'll read Tammy's first. So bear with me, Mike, while I read these questions. Okay. And she wants to know about Genesis 34, about God burying Moses' body where no man would find it, and Jude's account of the archangel Michael and Satan's conversation about Moses' body. So Tammy's question is, do you agree that although avoiding idolatry is a viable reason to hide the body, in light of the reality of today's DNA sciences, isn't it feasible to believe that God wanted to prevent mankind from obtaining Moses' DNA? I'd like to hear Mike's actual thoughts about this topic from the worldview in Jude's time, in contrast to our present-day worldview. In this day and age, in my faith as I understand it, I believe that being in the presence of God would have changed anyone's physical body. I believe Moses died because God revealed himself to Moses. Otherwise, after spending 40 days and 40 nights in God's presence, not even face to face, I would not be surprised if Moses' body, physical body, is still well preserved. And that's why God hid it. And Nathan also kind of echoes this, and he says, okay, the book of Jude, there is a reference to Michael battling over the body of Moses. Every time someone mentions the book of Jude, I can't help but wonder why they would have been fighting over the body of Moses.
Okay, well, I would say to start off, I don't, you know, if we're going to go by the ancient worldview, this has nothing to do with DNA. They don't know what DNA is, for one thing. But even those of us now who do, I don't think that any of this has anything to do with DNA at all. I don't think in the case of Moses that his DNA was affected. You have to remember, look, let's take Peter, James, and John. They see the glory of the unveiled Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. I mean, they're not changed in any way. You know, that this is sort of a cause and effect thing that I don't think is valid. I do think the idolatry trajectory is important, that Tammy pointed out. I think that's really important based on the biblical behavior with religious relics like the bronze serpent, and even the behavior of believers afterwards, you know, relic worship in, you know, late antiquity and Middle Ages and all that stuff. But the shining of Moses' face is not a property of Moses' body as the result of a DNA change. It was an after effect of being in God's presence. And again, you have other people in the presence of God, again, the glory. And incidentally, the transfiguration has clear touch points with glory passages in the Old Testament, again, by design to associate Jesus with the Old Testament glory. And again, there's nothing going on there as far as, you know, some visual change. So I don't think, you know, Moses' body was altered in any way. I think this is was a visual after effect, probably because of the number of days and all that stuff. I don't think Moses' body was or is preserved. I don't think it would matter other than, you know, the situation with idolatry. When it comes to Jude, this is actually really a convenient question. So it comes at the right time because what I'm gonna say about this dovetails on to what we just covered with Ezekiel 38 and 39 in part two. So if you haven't listened to part two of Ezekiel 38 and 39, you may want to do that so that you can process what I'm going to say here. But let's just start here with, I'm going to start here with a small quote from Bauckham's commentary. And this will kind of give you a flavor for the standard view, at least among scholars. Bauckham has spent a good bit of time on the epistles of Peter and Jude, and he's an expert in Second Temple literature, so it's a good source. But I think he sort of under argues a point because he's not as familiar with the Old Testament context as we wish he would be in this case. So in his commentary on Jude, on Jude 9, again, which is the relevant verse about this conflict between the devil and Michael for the body of Moses, he writes, the words refer, in Greek here, to a legal dispute. And specifically, the word that he picks out, in Greek it says, to diabolo, dia krinomenos, okay, in debate or in, you know, in debate with the devil, in debating the devil. The dia krinomai, or dia krino, the lemma is the legal word in question. It is legal vocabulary used elsewhere in the Septuagint, for example, and in other Greek literature. He says, the words refer to a legal dispute. The devil, in his ancient role as accuser, tried to establish Moses' guilt in order to prove him unworthy of honorable burial and to claim the body for himself, unquote. Now, that I think, reflects the standard view. I have a little bit of a bone to pick with that because I think, honestly, we can do better, but you know, we're certainly going to be the beneficiary of Bauckham's work when it comes to Second Temple Jewish texts that sort of track with this, with what I'm going to say, or that kind of lay behind it. Now, here's what I would say. Jude 9, again, is related. I think it is fair to say that it's part of a tradition, or borrows from Second Temple Jewish thinking that the Lord of the Dead tried to claim the body of Moses. I think that's pretty obvious. The tradition, though Bauckham doesn't seem aware of this, may extend from some of the elements we covered last time in part two of Ezekiel 38 and 39. Now note, think with me here, note that the place of Moses' burial has something to do with part two of our last episode on Ezekiel 38 and 39. Deuteronomy 34:6 says, and he, God, buried him, Moses, in the valley of the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. End of quote. That's Deuteronomy 34:6. The description doesn't give us a precise location for the burial, but what it does say is interesting. The valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. Sounds a lot like, and geographically corresponds to, the Valley of the Travelers, mentioned in Ezekiel 39:11. Now, if you listen to the last episode, I read a portion of the DDD entry on travelers, and I'm going to read this again, this little bit of it. DDD says, the Valley of the Ovarim, okay, that's the word for travelers, the Valley of the Ovarim is located east of the sea, in verse 11, Ezekiel 39:11. And we said, this is me interrupting now, we said the sea here is likely the Dead Sea, so it's in Moab. Okay, it's in that part of the world. It's in Transjordan. The Valley of the Ovarim is located east of the sea, again, which is probably the Dead Sea. So it was part of the Transjordan. This is a region which shows many traces of ancient cults of the dead, such as the megalithic monuments called dolmens and place names referring to the dead and the netherworld, namely Ovot, which means spirits of the dead, and Peor, which relates to the Baal of Peor, the Baal incident there. Again, Baal is the Lord of the Dead. And Avarim. Avarim, Ha-Ovarim. Okay, the place name Avarim, we talked about last time, how that likely, again, is related to or is named after Ovarim, the Valley of the Travelers. And who were the travelers? Again, you'd have to listen to the last episode, but basically this has to deal with this location being associated with the realm of the dead and the passing over to the realm of the dead, and that place was where the Rephaim were. Again, this it's in the Transjordan. There were Rephaim, you know, giant clans there, the giants of the spirits, you know, the spirits of the dead giants or the demons, and all this kind of stuff. All this whole matrix of ideas again is in play, I would suggest, in this episode. It's part of the backdrop to understanding Jude 9 and the struggle over the body of Moses. Now, Ovoth and Avarim, again, just by way of summary here, were places associated with the realm of the dead and the Rephaim. It seems possible, to me anyway, and I would say it's even reasonable, that Moses would have been buried in the place associated with the realm of the dead, in this part of the Transjordan. This is the gateway to the realm of the dead. Well, we're going to bury him there. God buries him there. The Rephaim were part of that underworld. Everybody goes to the underworld. Everybody dies. Again, you have to think like an Old Testament person here. Okay, you have to think like the Old Testament person. So, okay, he's right on the doorstep here. Well, let's bury him here because this is the gateway to the netherworld where we all go. We all go to Sheol. Now, it was the hope of the righteous to one day be removed from the grave. Okay, to be taken out of Sheol. So Sheol, again, all these terms, and we've talked about this many times on the show, terms like hell, terms like Gehenna, terms like Sheol, terms like the Valley of the Ovarim, okay, all these terms are, they're sort of linguistic or verbal necessities for us. They describe a place that actually, in reality, that the spirit world does not have earthly latitude and longitude. These are places associated with death and where the dead go. Again, for whatever reason, we can't necessarily completely capture the reasoning behind, you know, some of these terms and the places, but, you know, words like heaven and hell, and we still use words like passing over and all that. We do that because we're trying to describe the transition of the embodied life in this world, the world we know, the world we inhabit, and a world that is for the disembodied, or a different kind of body, or the spiritual place, the afterlife. And the only way we can describe that is to use terms of place and terms that involve latitude and longitude as though they were places. Okay, so this is what we've got going on here. So it shouldn't shock us that Moses winds up getting buried in a place that was associated with the passing over from this life to the next. The realm of the dead. Well, why would God send him to hell? God isn't sending him to hell. Okay, God is burying him. He's taking Moses' life, okay, if you want to put it that way. It's time for Moses to die or to depart from this world, if you want to resist the conclusion that Moses died, and some people want to argue that, but whatever. God is removing him from this terrestrial world and putting him in the next world. Okay, I think you have to conclude more than that because there's talk of a body here, but I'm trying to be generous here. So we've got a situation where it's time for Moses to depart into the next life, into the afterlife. Now, in the afterlife, there are good parts and bad parts in the spiritual world. We still think this way today, even though we have a New Testament. We go to the spiritual world, okay? The body, the soul, spirit separates from the body. We die. We go to the spiritual world, and that there are good parts to that. There's a good place and there's a bad place. Again, we use the same kind of descriptors here. Is the point? And so, if we look at the passage in that way, Moses, again, his death, his departure, is associated with the valley of the Ovarim, the realm of the dead. Now, let's go a little step further. I would say if you're looking at it that way, it is in turn quite understandable if there arose a Second Temple tradition about the body of Moses. Again, arguably Moses is the central figure of Israelite history. So if a tradition arose that Moses' body was contested by the Lord of the Dead, in other words, the person in charge there, Baal, or Baal-Zebul, again, Baal becomes the Satan figure, all that sort of stuff. You know, the Lord of the Dead, who, you know, in the Second Temple period in the New Testament is identified as Satan. Okay, it seems to suggest, though, that there was some sort of contention about not letting Moses pass to the good place. In other words, like to punish Moses, you know, to contest, you know, Moses' ultimate destiny. It seems reasonable that again, this idea could have arisen because of where Moses is buried and because of who else is there, okay, in this place. So he gets contested, again, by Satan, by the devil, you know, in this time period. You see this, you know, this tradition sort of develop. To me, that's understandable. Now, Michael was Israel's prince. He is the guardian of Yahweh's portion, according to Daniel 10 and Daniel 12. So he, you know, in some sense would be the logical candidate to go get Moses, you know, to deliver him again from this threat, you know, to claim the body of Moses for the eschatological land of promise. Remember, Moses didn't actually get to, you know, inhabit the promised land. He got to see it at a distance. But he goes and claims the body of Moses for the eschatological land of promise, which is the domain of Yahweh. It's Yahweh's house. It's Yahweh's place. It's where Yahweh lives. Okay, and so what I'm saying here is it seems reasonable that this tradition about Moses, because he was so important, could have arisen because of the context of where he dies and where he's buried and the associations with that place. So the idea of the tradition coming about doesn't surprise me really at all. Now, if this scenario is coherent in any way, and again, I'm suggesting that there's a lot to chew on here. I think it is coherent. Again, it may not be perfect, but again, there's a lot to chew on here. Then Baucom's speculation about this having something to do with guilt, I think, is a bit misguided. It's kind of on target, but it also misses the point. Now, Baucom refers to Zechariah 3:2. This is the scene where the angel, you know, you have the angel of Yahweh, you've got the Satan figure there, HaSatan, you've got Joshua the high priest who's guilty and being accused, you know, by the Satan figure. The problem I have with it is that the Satan figure of Zechariah is not the same as the devil in Second Temple Judaism or the New Testament. You don't have the Satan in the Old Testament sort of playing that role. You do have him as an accuser. Okay, and Joshua the high priest in Zechariah 3, again, he represents the guilt of the nation. And of course, he's going to be forgiven because in Zechariah we're dealing with, you know, coming out of the exile and all that sort of thing. But when it comes to Moses, Moses isn't responsible for that. So I don't know how you're transferring the guilt of the nation to Moses. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But again, this Baucom tries to connect these two things, I think, because this is where you get Satan vocabulary that might be useful to, you know, understanding Jude 9. But that's the part of his, and again, probably fair to say a majority argument. That's the part that I'm just saying doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, Moses isn't being accused of any unrighteousness like Joshua the high priest. Anyway, so on the positive side, Baucom does marshal some really interesting parallels to Jude 9 in pseudepigraphical texts. Again, and these could date anywhere from a couple centuries BC in the Second Temple period all the way to the first century. I'm just going to give you some references here because I don't want to, you know, well, I'm debating here. I'll read some of this because it's kind of interesting. But if you really want to get the full treatment here, you'd buy Baucom's Word Biblical Commentary and Second Peter and Jude, and you can get the whole thing. He refers to, for instance, Jubilees 17, 15 through 18, 16. Bauckham writes that this passage tells the story of the sacrifice of Isaac within the framework of a heavenly trial of Abraham, in which the prince Mastema, which is a Second Temple Jewish word for Satan, the Satan figure, appears as the accuser, arguing that Abraham's faithfulness should be tested. When Abraham proves faithful, it is the angel of the presence who, on God's behalf, intervenes to save Isaac in Genesis 22, while the prince of Mastema was put to shame, Jubilees 18:12. He also refers to something else in the Book of Jubilees. Bauckham writes, the Book of Jubilees makes further use of the theme of the contest between Satan and the angel, especially in chapter 48 of Jubilees, to illumine the career of Moses in the Exodus. According to Jubilees 48:2-3, it was the prince of Mastema, not the Lord, as in Genesis 4:24, who tried, or Exodus 4:24, who tried to kill Moses. So again, the Jubilees tradition, sort of subverts that. They don't want God to be killing Moses. They swap in the devil figure there to do that. And argues, again, Jubilees 48 argues that it was the angel of the presence who delivered Moses from the power of Mastema. Though Satan's motivation here, again, the Mastema is the Satan figure, though his motivation here plainly derives from his hatred toward God and God's people, it may be that the author still intends him to be seen in the role of accuser. It was Moses' failure to circumcise his son, Exodus 4:25, which put him into Satan's power, again, in this reading of the story. So what I'm going to stop there. What Bauckham does is he marshals texts like this that pit the Satan figure, the devil or Satan or a Satan figure against the angel of the presence or the angel of the Lord, and says, well, this might be the backdrop, the Second Temple Jewish backdrop to Jude 9. I think there is something to that, again, something to this idea, but I think we're sort of better off thinking about the geography here and what that would have telegraphed about the realm of the dead, the Valley of the Ovarim and all that. That's an important element too. So what I'm suggesting to all of you listening is take the Second Temple material, again, for what it's worth. Again, there are some interesting, possible parallels or precursors to Jude 9, but you need to factor in some Old Testament material, I think, to get a fuller picture of what people, were thinking. And again, what they are thinking, I'm suggesting, is that, look, Moses was so important to the Israelites, such a central figure, that when he went into the afterlife, there was resistance to allowing Moses to join the Lord. Okay, that was an idea. Now, did that really happen? Jude, brings this up. So we have an inscripturation, we have an inspired, comment to this effect. So I would say, yeah, something happened like that, that there was resistance to Moses, being with the Lord after he died. What that looked like, we don't really know. Maybe some of these texts are helpful, but the idea isn't that quaint when you think about the geography of it.
All right. Derek in Kansas has a question for Mike in regards to biblical genealogies. In the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11, Mike has said in the past that the genealogies have gaps and they were not meant to be exact ancestry, but rather a general bloodline type of thing, as well as paralleling the Sumerian kings list. However, it seems in extra-biblical literature, as well as early church commentaries, they assumed that it was direct lineage rather than a telescope ancestry. How would Mike reconcile that with the gaps? Or take, for instance, Jude 14, where it says Enoch is the seventh from Adam. How does that work with genealogical gaps? And does Mike believe that the men listed in the genealogies actually lived to the age that it says? Or is it purely a literary thing? For instance, did Methuselah actually live 969 years?
Yeah, there's a number of questions here. First of all, I would say that I haven't said and wouldn't say, and frankly, I don't know anybody that says, that there are gaps in all of the genealogies. I would also say that there may be gaps in genealogies. Doesn't mean that there are, if you have a gap in one, doesn't mean you have a gap in another, that sort of thing. So it's not an all or nothing kind of proposition. In regard to the ages, people can go up to drmsh.com, put in the word genealogy or mathematical, And again, I've blogged about this a number of times. I think there is some sort of mathematical thing going on with the genealogies that is literary. It's designed to telegraph something. Nobody's really come up with one that works all the time. Although if you search for that on my site, it leads to an article that gives you a summary of the approaches. There's certainly something going on with the Sumerian king list in that respect, that people have figured out what the cipher is. People have taken really good shots at the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11 to come up with a cipher. And again, some of the shots are better than others, but I do suspect that there is something mathematical going on there. And that would mean that the patriarchal figures here, these figures, you know, we can't assume that the numbers here are actually designed to give us their actual literal lifespan, that there's something else going on here, you know, for some theological reason. That in the space of the podcast here, that's about all I can say. I just say, go up to the site, get the article, get the summary, read through it, and you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about and why. So, you know, back to the gap issue. Again, nobody's saying there's gaps in every genealogy. I don't have any problem saying that Enoch is the seventh from Adam, like the text says he is. Now, with that in mind, though, okay, now think about this. Even though I have no trouble thinking Enoch was the seventh from Adam, you have to realize that Jude is just quoting what he's reading in the Old Testament. It may well be in real time that there were gaps in that genealogy, but Jude can't really quote something he doesn't know. He can't quote information he's never given. He's just quoting the Old Testament, and he's quoting it accurately. But that doesn't mean that there's something, you know, else that could be going on here. Now, I think in his case that we do have the seventh from Adam, I think the number seven is really important. Again, if you read the mathematical cipher article, you'll find out why. I think, especially with Enoch, that is a big deal. So I personally would think that, yeah, Enoch is the seventh from Adam, and that means something, again, theologically. Enoch's own number, 365, it would be significant. Again, you can read the material there. So this isn't sort of an either-or kind of thing that you can parse. But my view, again, is that I'm willing to bet that there are gaps in some of the genealogies and that the numbers there are, there's some sort of mathematical cipher going on. Now, what I would recommend to Derek and to the rest of the listeners is a book called, and it only exists in Kindle, unfortunately. I don't have Kindle, but I went to hear this guy at the last set of academic meetings. The Evangelical Theological Society had a full afternoon session on biblical genealogies. Doesn't that sound exciting? But I went to that. And this guy was one of the speakers. It's a book called God of the Gaps, Gaps in Biblical Genealogies Make It Impossible to Calculate the Date of Creation. Okay, it's a long, kind of clunky title. It's authored by two people, Hugh Henry and Daniel Dyke. And I think, as I recall, the guy that was there was Hugh Henry at the last ETS. But it was a really interesting session because he had approaches to gaps that I've not heard of before or seen. For example, he would take comments in the scripture about the number of generations between this or that event, which included the names of biblical figures that also happened to be in genealogies. And he showed how either certain names get skipped or how the time frame between the events could not be reconciled with the number of generations in the genealogies based on other passages that sort of define how long a generation is. Now, the point of his presentation was that it's not about just looking at lists of names. You have to look at statements made about figures and about time periods, about X number of years between this and that event or between generations, and then go look at the genealogy and ask yourself, well, you know, could this number of generations in the genealogy, could it account for that number of years that we know has to take place because of the Bible's own chronology? And he actually showed examples of where it just doesn't work. And so again, his hypothesis was that the genealogical information is selective. And in some cases, again, you have to conclude that there's skipping going on and that there must be gaps in the information and that what is used for a specific purpose to highlight someone or something, but you can't just use the numbers to do a strict chronology. So I would recommend that work, just because, again, I saw some things in that presentation that were just different. I'd not seen anybody take some of the approaches that this guy, these two guys did. Again, only one speaker was there, at least presenting, but I just found it really interesting. So it's called God of the Gaps, Gaps in Biblical Genealogies. We'll just cut the subtitle short, but it's only available in Kindle, unfortunately. So if you don't have Kindle like me, you can't actually go get, you know, a hard copy of it. I mean, I suppose at some point I'll go get a Kindle just to have this, but, you know, I have what was given at the session. It was just really interesting.
All right. Our next two questions are from Lindsay. And the first one is, Christians like to say that evil cannot dwell in God's presence, and that gives support to the Levitical system and the doctrine of hell. However, how do we conceive of Satan's presence before God in the Old Testament? Or what about fallen, but not yet judged, council members?
Well, you know, I have to admit that I'm not quite sure I understand the question. The idea, I'll just take a stab at it, though. The idea that evil cannot dwell in God's presence, I think, is more homiletical. It's more preaching than biblical in a certain sense. And what I mean by that is this. For example, God is omnipresent, right? Just a standard staple of theology proper, okay, that who God is by his nature. God is omnipresent. So that means there's no place where he isn't. And so evil is in his presence pretty much all the time. And the same is true in the spiritual world, since there's no part of that world off limits to God. You know, you're either omnipresent or you're not. And God is omnipresent. I mean, this is something that scripture teaches, I think, pretty clearly. And so God, quote, coexists with fallen divine beings all of the time. So that's why I say this idea to me is more preaching than it is really careful thinking biblically. Now, I say all that to say that I'd have to know what verses Lindsay is specifically thinking of for this idea that evil can't dwell in God's presence. You know, I'm not going to take a stab at specific verses. I know there are some that suggest some idea there like that, but I'd have to know what the specific verses are before venturing too much further. But you know, if I were to throw caution to the wind for a minute, I would add again that a term like hell is an afterlife term. It's not a place with latitude and longitude. It's a place in the spiritual world, and God is a resident in the spiritual world by definition. So that alone shows us that there's some sort of coexistence with other parts of the spiritual world and their inhabitants, because there is no place where God isn't. Consequently, again, I think that the point of any passage about God not wanting evil in his presence is really better understood as some teaching point or statement about defilement, or the fact that God doesn't tolerate evil in the sense of ever approving of it. Now, the Levitical system was about teaching humans the difference between them and God. Again, that's pretty transparent. It was about teaching people about his otherness, or between, you know, the difference between God's space and normal mundane space, sacred space versus, you know, other space. I doubt if divine beings don't know that there's a difference between where God is and where they are, or something like that. So I think there's a bit of a disconnect there too. But again, catch the main point. God is omnipresent. He is everywhere. There is no place where God isn't. And so in that sense, he is in the, quote, presence of evil and rebellious divine beings a lot. So that idea, you know, or that theological reality that is scriptural needs to have an impact on any verse that talks about God not liking evil in his presence. There has to be a relationship struck between those two ideas, but without having a specific verse to jump into, I think that right now that's about all I can say.
All right, Lindsay's second question is, in Mark 7, verse 31, there's a strange account of Jesus healing the deaf and dumb man. Jesus puts his fingers in his ears, spits, touches his tongue, and then says, "Be opened." Could this Gentile have understood Jesus as performing the mouth-opening ritual for idols? Could Jesus be enacting something similar, preparing this man as the idol image of God to receive God's indwelling spirit?
Yeah, I actually don't really think so. I don't think the opening of the mouth ceremony is in view for a couple of reasons. The ceremony itself, the ritual itself, represented birth, you know, for an idol. Again, it's the moment of animation. It also was a metaphor for rebirth, again, in a spiritual sense. Now, in this passage specifically, we don't really have any commentary to the effect of this person becomes a believer now. It's just absent. You know, we don't have it. So anything you'd say about it in that direction is based on no data. You know, it's based on silence. Now, for those interested in the opening of the mouth thing, again, to establish kind of how, you know, what it was for, I will post a couple of articles. There's two of them, and they're actually pretty long and really detailed, but it goes through the Egyptian ritual. And I used to have my students in the Egyptology class I taught here locally read both of these articles. They're really interesting because the opening of the mouth ritual mimics deliberately what you do with a newborn baby. In other words, how you clear its airways, like with your fingers and stuff like that, you know, what you do with the infant, and even really what we do today. They would actually do those same motions and have ritual objects to substitute for fingers and whatnot, you know, to like stick in the nose and all that. They would actually do that to idols, to mimic, you know, what they would do to newborn humans. And the idea was, this is the moment of birth. This is the moment of animation, again, for the idol and whatnot. So I'm gonna throw those in the folder that newsletter subscribers get access to. You know, they get the address, so to speak, to that folder. If you want to go up and read those two articles on the opening of the mouth, that's how you'd find them in the folder. You'd search for them that way. If you're into this kind of stuff, I think you'd find them really interesting. Now, let's go back to Mark 7. There is a parallel to this in Matthew 15, but that one's even less detailed. It's even more general. Both of the episodes in Matthew and Mark respectively precede the feeding of the 4,000. So again, we know that there's a parallel here, even without much detail. To be honest with you, there's really not much written specifically on this question, like you get with the spitting in the dirt and making clay. We've done an episode. It was either an episode or there was a Q&A on that about how there's a Dead Sea Scroll that ties Jesus spitting in the dirt and making clay and healing someone that way. It ties that to Jewish tradition about how God made man in the creation narrative. You know, if you didn't listen to that, the phrase that man is created from the dust of the ground, there was a strong tradition that what was meant there was that God spit in the dirt, made clay, and then made the man. And the reason they thought that was because of Jeremiah, the whole potter and clay description of how God, you know, made human beings. So you don't really have, though, for this, you don't have any clay in view. So it doesn't really apply to this passage without the clay. The clay is kind of important because of the Genesis tie-in and the potter and the clay tie-in. This is something sort of related but different. And to be honest with you, you're not going to find much in terms of commentaries and journal articles on this. The people who comment on it, they get lost in the geography. There's this big, huge debate of, does Mark understand, you know, the geography of Canaan, you know, in his day, and it's just a weird itinerary. It has Jesus skipping around all here and there. They get lost in the details about the geography. They get lost in the term Ephatha in the verse. Is that Aramaic or Hebrew? You know, this is the kind of thing scholars just get fixated on. So I'll be honest with you, you're not going to find very much that's terribly helpful, even in a normally good commentary. And so far, we don't have any specific parallels, you know, to that. Now, I think lastly, I would say, or I would add anyway, that even though there's no clay here, you still do have spit. Okay, so if you went back and listened to that earlier episode, you know, spit did have, you know, something to do with the act of creation. So I suppose that you could have had somebody think when they read this passage, somebody in the first century might think of a creator, but I'll be honest with you, I think it's a stretch, because of the absence of the clay element. Again, the clay was important because of the potter and clay metaphor for, you know, that we get in Jeremiah. So I that's probably not much help. But again, I don't think it's the opening of the mouth ritual. I don't think we have the real necessary elements, the point of those of that ritual specifically. We don't get those details mentioned in the passage.
All right, Matthew in the UK has a question. Am I correct in assuming that the angels mentioned in 1 Timothy 3:16 are the imprisoned angels that Jesus has spoken to?
Yeah, I don't think so. Rebellious divine beings aren't typically called angels without some qualifier. for clarity. Now, there's an exception, which I'll get to in a moment, but usually we get things like, quote, angels that sinned, or evil spirits, or spirits in prison, or the devil and his angels. Those qualifiers help identify what side a particular being is on. Now, the exception, the clear one anyway, is 1 Corinthians 6:3, don't you know that you're going to judge angels? Again, that's very likely a reference to the inheritance of the nations that we've talked about a lot on this podcast that I talk about in Unseen Realm. It's very, very likely a reference to the inheritance of the nations, the displacing of the fallen sons of God that, you know, get their beginning in Deuteronomy 32, 8, 9. But, you know, it could be a general reference to glorified believers outranking angels at the end of the eschaton. But again, I think that it is a reference to the displacement of the sons of God because of other language in Revelation 2 and 3. Again, you can go read that in Unseen Realm. If we look at Hebrews 1 and 2, you have references there to things like, you know, that God didn't help the angels, but he helped human beings again through the atonement of Christ. That obliquely might suggest that he has fallen angels, you know, angels that might need redemption and can't get it there. Again, the passage, I think, certainly can be read that way. And, you know, I've blogged recently about that I think gives us an interpretive clue to the question of angelic redemption. That at the very least, even if he's not targeting, you know, fallen angels in that Hebrews passage, he's making it clear that the atonement and the effect of the atonement was about humanity. I mean, that was the big deal because Jesus became incarnate as a man, not as an angel, but as a man. So again, that's an oblique reference. So it's not quite as clear of an exception that 1 Corinthians 6:3 would be, but usually we get some qualifier again to make the situation clear. And we don't have that in 1 Timothy 3:16. I would be, you know, with the mass of commentators here that would say scene of angels in that passage is probably best interpreted as the angels at the tomb, Luke 24:4. And I think even more specifically, Matthew 28:2. If you go to Matthew 28:2, let me just turn there real quickly. It says, "Behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it." Okay, and then it describes his appearance. It's an angel of the Lord. So some angel, you know, from God moves the stone, rolls the stone away. Now, you know, are we to presume that he never saw Jesus, or Jesus didn't like pop out and say, "Good job, this is what you were supposed to"? I mean, you'd have to assume that he never saw the risen Savior, which to me is really a stretch. So I think that, you know, what we have in that reference, scene of angels, is probably best understood as the opening of the tomb scene, you know, the resurrection, you know, kind of situation. Look at the order in 1 Timothy 3:16. "He was manifested in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory." I mean, you can create something of a chronology for that. It's not really precise because he's taken up in glory, you know, before, you know, the gospel really advances to the nations. So it's not a really good chronology, but it has all the elements there of like the book of Acts. And at least you could say, you could argue, as many scholars do, well, the beginning of this is the incarnation and the resurrection through the power of the Spirit, and then you have the seen by angels thing, which happens again after the vindication by the Spirit, which again most scholars would say is a reference to, you know, the being resurrected through the power of the Holy Spirit, which, you know, is language that you get from other passages. And so since angels follows that, a lot of commentators would say, not a lot, but almost everybody, you know, would say that scene of angels here is about the resurrection scene, the tomb scene. And I think that's pretty reasonable here.
All right. We'll end with Corey's question. What are some questions Mike wishes people would ask him, either regarding theology or even personal goals? What would Mike most enjoy helping people understand at this point in his life and work?
That's such an open-ended question. I should mention to start out, people could ask, you know, questions for Q&A that are personal questions, and I don't mind that at all. you know, off the top of my head, I'll tell you what I want to say, Trey. I want to say, yeah, I'd like people to ask, why did you let Trey win the fantasy football
league? Yeah, boy, you can't help that. That's unstoppable right there.
Yeah.
That's not a choice. But that's a.
That's honestly, as I saw that question, you know, that's the first thing that popped into my head. But, you know, getting a little more serious, I would sort of have two answers to this. You know, one is, you know, it's nice to be able to explain to people why I do what I do, specifically, you know, in terms of stuff that I do outside biblical studies, you know, kind of the, like the fringe stuff, like you read on Paleo Babel, you know, like why was Mike in the Ancient Aliens debunked documentary and all that stuff, UFO religions, why do I write fiction that's paranormal and supernatural stuff and, you know, UFO stuff, science fiction stuff, you know, why do I do those sorts of things? And the second one would be, you know, what books would I like to write in the future? And these things actually sort of dovetail. So I'm going to kind of just, you know, go off the top of my head here, even though I did make a little list. I have a little list, I should say, in a spreadsheet of books I'd like to write. So I can open that up here and take a look at that, because those are the two things, you know, why do you do what you do outside of pure biblical stuff, naked Bible stuff? And then, you know, what do you hope to produce in the future? And they are related. So I would say, as far as why I do what I do, if people are wondering about that, the best thing to do is go to my website, drmsh.com, and go to About, because I actually describe this, because I do get this question a good bit, you know, why do you do, you know, some of this strange stuff? What's the point? And most of the time people ask and they genuinely want to know. I mean, sometimes, you know, you're dealing with somebody that just wants to sort of poke fun at it. And that's fine as well, because I love to talk to those people, because I congratulate them on finding the group of people out there who don't need good thinking. You know, thank you for that. So these are the people that we should just leave alone and let them basically go to hell if they're lost because they believe lots of stupid stuff. So again, that, and I'll put it that way too, you know, to people, you know, thank you for identifying the people that we shouldn't care about, or that as biblical scholars, we can just sort of dismiss. Thanks for that. And that usually shuts down the kind of, you know, person, you know, who just wants to poke fun at it. Because my next question, my follow-up would be, well, what are you doing? Can you suggest something better? And better isn't leave them alone. Okay, can you give me a positive substitute? I'm willing to take your advice and your instruction, your good suggestions here. And by that time, they usually clam up. So the point, again, is well taken. I do this because I don't like when people get misled, whether it's about biblical stuff or in these other realms. Because to be honest with you, these other realms, the Paleo Babel stuff, the weird, you know, Christian Middle Earth, or just Middle Earth in general, non-Christian Middle Earth, ancient aliens, you know, Gnosticism, Zeitgeist, all this stuff has a tremendous reach. We're talking millions and millions and millions of people filter things like the Bible and Jesus through those things. And if you don't have anybody who has good theology and who cares, if you don't have anybody occupying that space, sort of, you know, standing in that gap just a little bit, if you don't have anybody doing that, guess what? People aren't going to hear that, you know what? The Bible doesn't really say that. Or, you know what? You're really misunderstanding this passage, or you've been misled by someone who says this or that about the Bible or about Jesus or about God. If you don't have somebody doing that, they're not going to find it. You know, you go, well, just trust the Lord. Okay, you know, we'll trust the Lord. Well, when we trust the Lord, I mean, at least in New Testament thinking, we get off our butts too. We actually try to do something so that God has some person to actually use and use to influence people. Okay, so that's really why I do what I do. But you could read the About page. You know, I care that people don't get sucked in by what I call cyber twaddle on the internet about the Bible and the ancient world. I care that they don't swap in extraterrestrials and aliens and psychic this or that for theism. Okay, I care about that. I care about how science fiction topics, you know, like an extraterrestrial reality or transhumanism or artificial intelligence, and all these things are actually related. People who don't understand that they're related don't have their head in the material. So I guess we can give them a pass for that. But all of these things are related, and they are all attempts to displace theism and Christianity. Science fiction and the paranormal capture the imagination by offering a means to our own divinity, okay, our own divinity, and glimpses of other reality. Space is heaven without the biblical God. Again, these are very simple thoughts that propel lots of what people encounter on the internet. They propel major motion pictures. They propel comic books. Somebody needs to have their head in that material. And I have had my head in it for a long time. And I'm not an expert in any of it, but I've had my head in it long enough that I can see it with clarity. And so, you know, it'd be great to have more help. It'd be great to, instead of having people kind of, you know, chortle over it, it would be great to have people, you know, who were invested, had high content knowledge or subject matter expert, helping to produce good things to just, you know, for the person who their faith is the new age, or their faith, you know, you can't really call it the new age anymore. Their faith is the post-Christian, techno-scientific, extraterrestrial, quasi-paranormal, new physics sort of model. Okay. The person that is their religion, they just, you know, again, need to be brought into a theological conversation. And the way to do that is not to say, you know, hand them a track and say, come to church next week. The way to do that is to try to engage them on their turf. And the only way you can do that is to go out and meet them and have a decent amount of knowledge about how they think. So that's why I do it. Now, you know, what do I want to write? I mean, there's all sorts of books I want to write. I would like to write not just one, but several books on a Christian approach to the paranormal. In my spreadsheet, I have this broken down into mental phenomena, physical phenomena, divinatory phenomena, and preternatural phenomena. I mean, I could do four books on that. Again, this is my wish list. You know, if I actually could do what Mike does, what Mike's capable of doing, and actually have full-time hours to do it, I'd be writing those books. I'd be writing a book on, again, several books. I'm just looking at my spreadsheet now, on ancient astronauts. I have three volumes there I'd love to do. The Bible, you know, volume one would be, again, how the ancient astronaut myth is, quote-unquote, defended from the Bible and Christian art. Volume two would be ancient texts and artifacts. And volume three would be what I call occult pseudoscience. And all these are big themes. They propel the ancient astronaut narrative. I'd love to do a book on, you know, responding to zeitgeist. Another one I have here is Christianity Astray, 10 Self-Inflicted Wounds That Are Killing the Church. Again, that's more sort of inside baseball. And I think, you know, the stuff the church is doing to itself that really harm it now and in the future. You know, I'd like to do a book on infant salvation. I think it would be really a wonderful topic. Would give people a lot of comfort. This is essentially my Romans 5:12, you know, material. That just gives you an idea. Now, we're going to do some of that. We're going to do as much as we can in video with the Fringe Pop TV show. If you don't know what that is, then you're not a subscriber to my newsletter. We are in the process of creating a TV show that will not air until probably close to 2018, but a response show to all things strange and weird, all things fringy. Again, and it's not a debunking show. It's not a beat down kind of show. It's here's this fringe topic. What's worth thinking about here? What's real and what isn't? It's about clear thinking, logical thinking, primary sources, you know, linking what you think to evidence that's real, and then sort of going from there. Now, if you've listened to Paranormal, again, our podcast, it gives you a bit of an idea. But we're gonna condense it into episodes that are 20, 25 minutes long. We have a studio now. We've got nice props. You know, we have some people committed again to give their time. I mean, there are things in process that I'm not gonna take podcast time here to go into too much detail. Again, if you want to know, you have to subscribe to the newsletter because that's when I'll give links to, you know, pictures of this or that, or, you know, talk about it in more detail. And lastly, I should mention here that my employer, Faith Life, has also, you know, sort of stepped up to the plate here and created at least something that we hope will get other Christians interested in the topic so that they begin to treat the topic of UFOs and all that, that weird world, you know, UFOs and ancient astronauts. They begin to see that, hey, this is a real issue, and it's a theological issue. It's a spiritual issue. So Faith Life, they have a streaming TV channel, and almost a year, last summer, we filmed what has become a 90-minute sort of documentary that we're calling Aliens and Demons, The Search for an Unseen Realm, with a question mark, I think. Anyway, you can actually watch the trailer, and you know, it's a full-length film. It's 90 minutes of interviewing me about these topics. And honestly, they really put a lot of time into it. The visuals are really nice. Trey has watched the trailer. It's really well done. It's nicely done. But they're going to be using that to get people to sign up for Faith Life TV, where there's lots of other content, including some of my content, but lots of other scholars and other people that are just interesting as far as interviews and courses and whatnot. But if you want the link, I'm actually not going to reveal the link here. If you want the link now, before a week or two when it'll actually be unveiled, subscribe to the newsletter. I will stick the link to the documentary in there. And if you sign up, you know, for Faith Life TV, it's like $5 a month. You can watch the whole thing. Again, this isn't me. I don't make any money off of it. This is my employer. But it's a well done piece of work in this area, so I'm getting some help there too, just to do useful things for the post-Christian person. Again, the post-modern, post-Christian person, that this is their worldview, this is their faith. As much as you think it's just silly and nonsense, and honestly, a lot of it is, but the way it's marketed in the wild world of the internet and TV, like shows like Ancient Aliens that are now in its 11th season, if you can believe that, it's pretty slick. And it attracts a lot of viewers. And it frankly seduces a lot of people intellectually. And if there's no response to it, well, then I guess we can, you know, the outcome is kind of, you know, academic at that point.
Yeah, Mike, and I believe that documentary comes out April 14th, which is already out. So
you can. Okay. See, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the dates and whatnot, but yeah, I knew it was close, but there you go. April 14th is when it came out.
And also, Mike, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned you're speaking in Florida on May 20th, mm-hmm. but you've got a couple more speaking engagements in Chicago on May 2nd. You want to give them a shout out, and then also another one in Washington.
Yeah, I'm going to be on May 2nd, I'm going to be at Oakton Community College. It's a 1-hour lecture on Nazi occultism. If you've read The Portent, you know, it's going to be, you know, some of that content. I don't know what the facility holds in terms of the room that they're going to have us in, but you could, again, go up to my website, click on the event on the calendar, you'll get the contact person, their email, professor there at the community college. So I'm going to be there on May 2nd. And May, what was it, the 13th? I'm not 13th. Looking at my calendar. 13th, mm-hmm. Yeah, here locally in Washington. Sunrise Baptist Church, a friend of mine here at the company, Miles Custis, who works, you know, in our editorial department, and Miles has a master's in biblical studies, biblical languages. His church is having me in for a day to talk about where we got the Bible. So that's actually a day event, you know, a whole day event. We'll have lunch in between. So those are the things in May coming up.
All right. Sounds good, Mike. Well, that's it. Just like that, we're done. And I just want to remind people, don't forget to send me your questions at treystrickland@gmail.com. You can get that on our nakedbiblepodcast.com website. And when you do send me your questions, don't forget to include where you're from. And Mike, we appreciate you answering our questions. And just want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.